you know, one of the ways we look at things like this is sort of through an old consensus building technique I learned, I don't know how long ago now, but sitting down and kind of putting the important things in our lives into buckets. So all members of our family are welcome to be a part of this, and then figure out what we would love to have, what we would like to have, and what we can live with. When you put things in buckets that way, I think it helps clarify what the priorities really are, because you start to realize very quick, and you have to reassess, like, can I still live with this, or, you know, do I need to change this? So it is a check-in. There's a website I've used called Clear Communicate, developed by another camp director friend of mine, and he has a lot of great tools for helping people to communicate more honestly. But one of the pieces he taught me was this idea of asking for 100%, where the expectation that goes two ways is, like, if you and I live together, if I want something from you, I must ask you for it. That's the burden on me. But then the burden gets passed to you that if you don't want to give it to me, then you must tell me. So
right.
We try to have this expectation among all lines of relationship in our family. So from me to each of my sons, from me to my wife, and all of them to each other too, because the thing we want to really avoid is someone having an unmet need that's unspoken. I think that's when the resentment can really build. And yeah. So when it comes to routine, you know, sometimes it's obvious when people are asking for 100% that we can't meet 100% of everyone's needs. But at least that gets it out on the table, and we can kind of jigsaw puzzle it together from there.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Wednesday, April 15th. My guest today is James Davis, a friend of mine, father of three, an entrepreneur, a longtime member of New Hampshire's Free Coast community, School Sucks listener, two-time previous School Sucks guest, and he is a podcaster in his own right. He and his wife, we actually talked about this on the show around this time last year. He has about 50 episodes of a podcast called One Free Family. You see, I use that in the featured image for today's show. It's a wonderful unschooling and parenting resource. And even though the show is not currently active, you can find it anywhere podcasts are found. So today's show is about mindset advice. It's a show we both hope will provide some helpful outreach resources for you. And maybe you could take them and pass them along to some parents that you know who are currently exploring how to help their children learn and thrive outside of school. Good news, that's where almost all learning and thriving in life actually takes place. So if you are somebody who had this passed along to you and you're listening right now, I just want to say thank you so much. I am a very nice guy. My guest today is a very nice guy. We appreciate you taking a chance with us, especially after seeing the title of the show. Good heavens, it's called School Sucks. I mean, who hosts this thing, you say to yourself? Beavis and Butthead? Who would say such a thing? Who would be so brash? Well, I used to be a teacher, and kids would say that to me all the time. That was one of the inspirations, but there are others. And I would ask you, as your children get further and further away from the routine of being in school every single day, committing 45 to 50 hours a week to their schooling, as that moves further and further into your family's past, you know, maybe you've been at it for 4, 5, 6 weeks at this point, even though it is a challenging time for everybody, I'd be interested to see if you noticed more energy, more enthusiasm, more of an embrace of independence, more initiative, more optimism than you have typically seen directed towards learning pursuits through school. And I hope, even though this situation is far from ideal right now for everybody, that your kids being able to reclaim so much of their time and mental energy, you start to notice some really positive changes. So if this is the first episode you've ever listened to, I hope you enjoy it. And I'm really confident that I picked the right guest. As always, I look forward to your feedback about this conversation. Thank you so much for listening, and take care.
I've got to do on the way.
James Davis, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm very excited to be back, all things considered.
Indeed. Yeah, we are recording this on April 13th. I'd say a lot has happened since the last time we talked, but that would be true if the last time we talked was a week ago. You're in New Hampshire. I'm actually in New Hampshire right now, as I was telling you about before the show. Right. How are things going for you, for your family, and for your community there, as connected as we could possibly be? I've been trying to connect a few people in the New Hampshire Seacoast area periodically, but yeah, what's your experience been?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual, obviously, but I think, you know, one of the pieces of feedback I've gotten from other family and friends is, well, hey, you're homeschooling anyway, right? So this is probably, and you work from home anyway, right? So this is probably affecting you all not very much. And that hasn't been my experience, actually. You know, I think some people picture what everyone is doing right now is sort of homeschooling, you know, the people that are pulled out of school and getting on Zoom calls with their trigonometry professor or whatever. But that was not how we were homeschooling. We were seeing friends very frequently. You know, my kids have a lot of athletic pursuits, like rock climbing, skiing, and to have all that sort of taken away from them. And they're pretty young, you know, 9, 7, and 4, to have all that taken away overnight was definitely pretty jarring. But I'd say by this time, you know, we've been at this about a month now. I think we've found a pretty decent rhythm and certainly doing a lot better in all respects than we were a couple weeks ago.
What is their level of awareness about what's happening and how are you talking to them about it?
Yeah, they're very aware. I mean, aside from our 4-year-old who just would never comprehend such a thing.
Sure.
The older ones are quite aware. You know, we still get out once or twice a week to go hiking because we're still permitted to do that here in New Hampshire. And we'll see people and try to steer clear. You know, they'll see people in full, you know, biohazard gear or whatever out on the trails. And that'll be a point of curiosity and discussion. But I think they're aware that the world is very unsettled right now. I don't think they're very fearful, which is really nice. And, you know, we actually happen to live next door to my parents. They bought a house right next to us a couple of years ago, and they're part of our kind of quarantine. We're able to all be together. And yeah, it's, I think for them, they were struggling a lot in the first couple of weeks, missing out on all of their, you know, touch points, but they've found more rhythm than even we have for sure.
It's funny. You have 3 boys, exactly the same spacing as me and my brothers. I noticed.
Really?
Yeah. When I was like age-wise, when I was reading your blog, I noticed that.
That's funny.
Earlier today. Yeah, it is. And I just for a moment, I pictured like the three of us when I was 9 being the oldest going through this situation. And yeah, I mean, you bring up an interesting point about misconceptions that people might have. It's like, oh, well, you're already homeschooling and working from home anyway, so this is just business as usual. And that this forced compulsory schooling at home is being called homeschooling. And, you know, we even use the term homeschooling for, you know, the real world education that families like you do, because I think homeschooling paints this picture for people. Well, you already do school at home. You do so much more than school. Right. I mean, you're doing, I think, the antithesis of what school is in many ways in and around your home and in your community, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, when this is hard. So you understand this as being someone who could be slapped with the label libertarian, but when you're a part of, when you can be labeled as something, many people will assume that you're exactly like the first image that they conjure up in their own head. So
it's true.
I've got a couple of these going for me now. but homeschooler is a funny one because like when we were growing up, I don't know if you even knew any homeschoolers, but the ones I knew were of the Christian variety, like the religious homeschoolers, and they were weird families. That's just how I perceived them. Maybe they were actually really awesome. And if I met them today, I would really get along with them, but it was really a pretty fringe thing to do. And for reasons that I would not homeschool my own children. And even though the tent is much larger these days than it used to be. I still think people have a lot of assumptions when they picture what homeschooling looks like. But yeah, I mean, we do no formal schooling at all. My kids get up to a lot of different things. And, you know, I mentioned some of their athletic pursuits and they have, you know, roughly academic pursuits as well. You know, sometimes those tie into non-academic activities. Like my one son is getting very good with Microsoft Excel because he likes to make spreadsheets to calculate how many people he's killing when he plays Fortnite and, you know, if he's placing higher and the averages. And, you know, I help him learn how to do that kind of data analysis and so on. But yeah, it doesn't really look a whole lot like what people are doing in their homes now, like hopping on Zoom and trying to do a Spanish class and, you know, who knows what. I can't even really empathize with it. But one thing I am noticing is that, well, I'm noticing two things. One side, my do-gooder type friends are really struggling with this. They're very stressed out that their kids aren't keeping up and that they're having trouble submitting the paperwork and what are the testing going to look like and all that sort of thing. But then I do notice a large variety of people that are kind of just saying, to hell with this. You know, they're just like, wow, we can't possibly keep up with all this. I'm not going to work from home and force all my three kids to take their Zoom meetings every day. So they're kind of just, I don't know if they're being civilly disobedient, but they're at least turning their nose up at it and saying, just forget it, man. We'll tune back in, whether it's school or some other option, when the dust settles on this, which I think is pretty sensible.
Have either of these groups of people come to you for advice in this situation, knowing that you are a longtime, you know, homeschooler?
Yeah, well, a couple people I work with through different business endeavors, they have young kids and they've reached out and been like, what the hell am I supposed to do? You know, like one guy's our CTO of my normal company and he's got two really young sons too. And it's kind of funny because his kids are like 7 and 4 or something like that. And as best I can tell, the research suggests that you don't need any academic instruction at all at those age and that play, even like the academic types would argue that you don't really need any academic instruction at those ages to even to maximize academic performance. And so when I try to talk to him, you know, it's just mostly just talking people down off the ledge. It's letting them know that you have time, right? I mean, if your kid can go 2 months during the summer without any academic instruction, surely he can go 2 months in the spring without any academic instruction. And if you really feel compelled to fire it back up, if you feel like he's not thriving or, you know, feeling neglected or not engaged or not stimulated, then sure, be in touch with your own kid. But I think now more than ever, it's a time to kind of just ignore what the central authorities are saying. They had no plan for this, right? Like they right. didn't know this was going to happen. This was not in their toolkit whatsoever to deal with. And they're doing their best. And I, you know, I have friends who are teachers and I commend them for how hard they're trying to keep up with what the school is now demanding of them, but they don't know what they're doing. There was no plan. They're just grasping at straws like the rest of us. So I say, just take a deep breath, you know, tune back in later on and try not to stress yourself out. Cause I think the most important thing, the thing you can control the most is your own mentality. How are you interacting with your own kids? Are you more stressed? Are you raising your voice more often? Are you being more demanding? Are you feeling more tired? Cause if you're in touch with those things, that will make a big impact on how your kids are processing right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly true that parents had a lot of things sprung on them at once where there's a lot of things that just seem to be completely automatized. And that's obviously been, I think, one of our criticisms of how most families like interact with school is it's just taken as it's made synonymous with education and then just assumed to be happening once the kid departs on the bus. And I understand that. And I say it all the time, like I have sympathy for that. My parents did that. Almost everybody we know does. I mean, maybe you and I know a higher percentage of people who don't, but almost everybody does that. And then all of a sudden they had this situation where everything that they counted on was taken away all at once. And this is an incredibly stressful proposition to have to suddenly play the role of teacher in the home. And did anybody give you any indication of like what schools were asking of them?
Yeah. Well, two close friends of mine from a past life, I guess by now, they have a kindergarten age daughter. And they're two very brilliant people. And I guess I won't give too much information, but one of them is like a known person in her field, speaks at conferences, that sort of thing. And they were stressing out on Facebook about this because for kindergarten in their district, they were having to submit paperwork and, you know, make sure all the not graded work, but like, yeah, make sure all the homework and all that stuff was being submitted on time. And teachers were reaching out and feeling stressed that people weren't following the protocol in the proper way and the system was Byzantine and so on. And it just seems incredible. I mean, if that's happening at kindergarten, forget about what might be happening in eighth grade, you know, where the stakes start to raise up a little bit. High school, people preparing for AP exams. I think it's just stress, you know, it's just cortisol levels through the roof. It's people interacting in ways they wouldn't normally interact. And I think sometimes I forget what things I've gotten from you and what things I've sort of come up with on my own, because I was obviously such a big fan of the show early on. But I think those unintended lessons we're teaching kids right now, like how do we process a crisis? What do we prioritize in a crisis? That's what I'm really trying to focus on.
What are you showing kids? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like what do I, like at the end of the day, is just getting the schoolwork in the most important thing, come hell or high water? And, you know, all the tears and the stress and the anxiety and the yelling from upstairs to downstairs, I'm trying to work, you know, you keep doing your schoolwork. Mm-hmm. Like, is it going to amount to more positive outcomes in the future for your child? Is it really the time? And then of course I would ask after that, is any time really the time? Because if you decide that you want to prioritize connection and you know, focusing on helping your kids to understand that they're loved and that you're going to get through this all right. You know, I would argue that you can do that all year round for your child's entire life. But I know that's a little bit radical for folks. So.
Right. So I thought about, you know, we're kind of getting into it now, but I thought about the conversation we were going to have today as kind of outreach, right? Even if we can't directly connect, maybe more people are looking for homeschooling resources at this point. That's definitely true. And there's, you know, something I think a little bit tragic about that, that what just got imposed on every family in the United States is being called, you know, this is what homeschooling is like, right? Yeah. And obviously that's not the case at all. So maybe there are more people looking at for resources, but most of the people in this audience who are parents are already extremely on board with this mode of educating and learning. And they probably have lots of people that they would like to reach out to. So I thought of this as, you know, an outreach resource for those kinds of people. Like, I have two brothers, like I said, who, even though they're both, you know, one 2 years, one 5 years younger than me, they have kids and they both work. And I think they're both in sales and they're both still working and they're both still going to work at this wow. point. For one brother is married, so they're able to like share childcare responsibilities. And my other brother, his daughter is 14. I'm actually thinking about interviewing her soon. Just to get her take on what the last month and a half or so has been like. But she's able to obviously take care of herself during the day. But even if I can't send them this to them and get them to listen to this, I know that there's a lot of people who have others in their lives who are sort of, you know, right on the edge and now really having a lot of questions and really having a lot of frustrations. And they need some kind of, you know, mindset guidance with this whole thing. And you offered one piece of advice, and I wanted you to elaborate on it a little bit, this take a breather idea. I think we've all struggled with this maybe a little bit over the last month, where there's just such an inundation of new information every day that it is a little bit hard to unplug and reset and do all those things. But as a parent in this situation, what does that mean as far as like elaborating on take a breather?
Yeah, so I think we have a tendency towards urgency. You know, and maybe it's the social media era. Maybe it was just always like this. But when new news comes out, you'll see this. People jump out of their chairs to try to be the first one with this or that take. You know, this country is handling things poorly. This country is handling things well. And they do that not only on this kind of geopolitical scale, but they also do it in their own homes. You know, it's this news just came out. Now we need to wipe down all our groceries. Or this news just came out. Now we have to wear masks, even though yesterday we didn't. But you're a scumbag if you don't. And I think people get really wrapped up in taking immediate action on things. And I think immediate action can be really helpful in some cases, but by and large, you know, like our tendency towards having immediate reactions to things, I think comes from our evolutionary past, where emotional decision-making was a lot more beneficial than it is today, right? Where when you're a caveman and, you know, you see the neighboring tribe coming over the hill, you don't want to think, should I talk to them first or should I get out my spear? It's okay to have an emotional reaction, just kind of go for it, right?
Yeah, it's think fast, like Daniel Kahneman says in his book, right? Think fast versus think slow. So people rely on all these heuristics, these thinking shortcuts.
And that can be useful. When you have to make a fast decision, like you're sitting next to someone on a train and some part of your brain says, hey, I should talk to her. You know, like you just go for it. You don't need to make a list of pros and cons and do all the whole thing. But when it comes to things, situations like this, I don't actually think even though there is, I believe, real danger out there in the world right now, I don't think you have to make all your decisions overnight. And so the idea of taking a breather simply means give yourself some space between stimulus and response. You know, your gut might be telling you that your kid is not going to get into the greatest college in the world anymore. But just sit back, take a week, take more time and try to get yourself into the place. Like, I don't know if you've gotten or dug into this very much, but a mutual friend of ours, Matt Amberson, who I know has been on the show before, he got me into internal family systems. I'm sure we've at least heard of it.
Matt and I actually did a series about it with Wes Bertrand, maybe five.
Oh, you did a whole series about it. Oh, yeah. I guess I just missed that completely.
What was it called? Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience 2015, starring Wes Bertrand and Matt Amberson.
You know, it's funny because I feel like I listened to those episodes, but I must just not have been in tune with, because I remember listening to the A-score stuff. But anyways,
it was all the IFS that we did. I mean, we've talked about it since then here and there, but most of it was embedded into that series. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really resonate with IFS when it comes to things like this, because, you know, there are all these different parts of us that are sending us little signals about how we have to handle situations like these. But I think what we're really trying to sort for is, how does our self, you know, this rational sort of higher being that can micromanages all of these little parts of ourselves, how does that part of us think, you know? And I don't think you can do that when you're in this heightened emotional state, when you're operating from a place of fear. And what I'm hoping to do in a situation like this is actually just make the best decision. I don't want to make the fastest decision. So for me, that's really, yeah, that's all I'm trying to look for is, how do I sift down to the me that's there when times are not stressful? Because that's the person who's made most of the good decisions in my life. And the parts of me that have made most of the bad ones and gotten me in the most trouble happen to be the emotional ones that make decisions really quickly. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to prioritize when I say take a breather.
Yeah. And I think as far as IFS is concerned, there has to be, tell me if you agree, there has to be that all parts are welcome approach to everything that's going on in our minds too, because there is obviously, I mean, I don't know, is it, for the last like 10, 12 days, I've really just felt a leveling off where it's like all the anxieties, like the internally generated anxieties that I've had for so long, whether they're physical or they're mental or they're worried, it's just like the world said, you don't have time for that stuff anymore.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a calm emerges in this situation where I was very fight or flight a month ago today.
Hmm.
I got in my car. This was a decision that I made in a span of 24 hours, right? I had been kind of watching the situation for a couple of weeks, and I started to see things happen specifically in the state of New York. Now, I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania now. My family and loved ones are in New Hampshire. So I see what's developing in New York, and I say, geez, I better get out of here, or any day now, I might not be able to get from Pittsburgh to New Hampshire because you have to drive through New York, and I'm certainly not going to get on a plane. And then there's other states where there is hot spots, but they also have lots of government that they like to use. Like, we live really close to the Mass border, right? Here in New Hampshire, and we can see lots of Massachusetts local news. When there's going to be a snowstorm, it seems like the culture, the political culture in New Hampshire is like, oh, great, a snowstorm. The political culture in Massachusetts is like, let's have a press conference. Let's call in the Massachusetts Department of Emergency Management. Let's tell people 15 things that they should and shouldn't do. Like, it was comical to watch Deval Patrick, the former governor of the state, run these press conferences. It's a combination of an asteroid is about to hit the earth and he's about to take a bunch of elementary school kids out for recess. You know, like, that's the tone of a snowstorm. So I'm thinking, okay, Massachusetts is like that. Connecticut is like that. New York is definitely like that. And that's the path I got to travel. So I packed up, I hastily packed up and split to get back here in case all of those, that whole travel route became impassable. I obviously realize now I could have done that trip a week ago, probably without any, maybe 2 weeks ago without any hassle. I know every day it's kind of a difficult situation because, like, if I go back to Pittsburgh, can I get back here if I need to, or am I going to get stuck there? But the whole point of this, this tangent was, in the beginning, it was like, okay, I realized I didn't act fast enough, right? I didn't plan far out ahead enough. So now it's time for panic mode. But now, you know, I've done all the preparations I need to do across all the areas you need to prepare, looking at what's inside of my sphere of control and doing those things. And that just kind of produces, I'm sure you've experienced this too, a kind of ease of mind with this whole situation, knowing that it's very dynamic, knowing that it's going to be different tomorrow, 5 days from now, a week from now, maybe someday. I've started to feel like possibly it will get better, but I'm also preparing for lots of unforeseen, but also foreseen things that could, as far as like, I don't like it when people isolate their conversations to the virus itself and don't see all of the other outcomes that are possible. Almost as if to say, like, how could this one domino knock down all these other dominoes? You know?
Right. Yeah. So I think it's, you made some really key observations there. I think one that really resonated with me was the idea of preparedness. And unfortunately, I guess preppers are another pejorative that people will use at people. But one of the reasons I feel like I was more empowered to take a breather when all this started happening was that I had cultivated most of my life to not be dependent upon outside structures to function. Yeah. And so, you know, we had 5 years ago, we had 6 months worth of emergency food and water, right? We are able to defend ourselves if heaven forbid it should come to that. We have our kids at home anyway. We're not dependent upon the state to babysit our kids for 40 hours a week either, or however long it is these days. And I think that certainly empowered us to not be as stressed out right away. And I think this also, you know, I take that level of preparedness into my personal life and especially my parenting life as well, because I know that most of the times that I've acted the worst as a parent or as a spouse have been when I was hit with a novel situation that I wasn't emotionally prepared for. So from right when my infant child was not sleeping through the night well, to the first time my one kid hurt the other kid, and on and on and on up the list. You know, the first time my kid was exposed to someone saying a racial slur, right? All these different things that really struck a chord with me emotionally. I wasn't prepared for a lot of those right away. And so I had stronger emotional reactions that I would like to, than I would have liked to have. You know, I reacted in ways probably that just my parents acted or the way other authorities acted. And so part of my journey, trying to be a better person and parent is mentally preparing myself and saying, if such and such a situation arises, how will I approach it? You know, because even if I've just asked myself that question a single time, the likelihood that I'll respond in a way that I'm proud of goes up dramatically. So this was certainly a new situation that I wasn't prepared for, but I think all that other preparative work, is that a word? Prepared? Yep. I think that put me in a good position to not be as stressed out initially, but I'm also now trying to prepare for the next things, right? Because I think we haven't seen the weirdest things that have resulted from this. I think those are still down the road. So trying to wrap my mind around that and be better off for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like those are the dominoes that I think are coming. And Yeah, I think there will be days where things seem like they're staying the same and days where things seem like they're getting better, right? That seems to be a tone that I've just seen over the last week, right? But this is not the end of this. And I think there's going to be more rounds of deeper preparation. And it sounds like through all that, a second piece of advice that's emerging here is just keeping emotional stability in check, right?
Yeah. And then I think most of that comes from preparedness. And, you know, if you want to put it back through an IFS framework, we can understand that the emotional parts of ourselves, the fearful parts of ourselves, they have good intentions for us, right? They don't want us to have bad lives or make bad decisions. It's just that those parts are highly motivated by safety, right? And I think that's good. And again, if you were living in caveman times and there were saber-toothed tigers or whatever hovering outside of the cave, then maybe you would react strongly to your child wandering out of the cave, right? Grab them, scream at them, you know, and you would take any precautionary steps necessary to make sure that people were safe. But my personal understanding of the situation currently is that I don't think we are in those times right now. I don't think that wandering out of the house or making one wrong misstep, certainly not in your academic life, I don't think any of that will have lifelong damaging consequences. So what I want to, again, portray to my children and my family and those who look to me for guidance in any community is that I think there is a path towards handling this without, you know, justifying our emotional outbursts or being damaged and broken or just totally defeated all the time. Because I think, you know, this is a problem I've had with like personality tests, right? Myers-Briggs, things like that. I think there's useful ways to use those tests, but then I think also oftentimes people use those as enablers, right? They'll say, well, hey, I'm just an INFJ, so therefore I handle situations like this. It's like, well, maybe that's your default way of handling things, but you're not, you know, you don't have to forever, right? Or I'm an Italian, so I have a temper. It's like, okay, well, know that your natural reaction to things is to react with a temper, but you can check in with yourself around how you want to do that.
Yeah, anyone who's ever worked in special ed can identify with that, right? Because kids get diagnosed and then that diagnosis becomes very deterministic. It's like,
oh yeah, I've had tons of experiences like that. Autism was the big one for me when I was really working with kids in the most hands-on way in the early 2010s, where between autism and ADD, people would get these diagnoses, I think somewhat loosely in many cases, but when I would approach them and talk to them about trying to help them find a better path for their lives, they would refer back to these diagnoses as this permanent rain cloud over their head that would never help them to accomplish the things I was suggesting that they might be able to accomplish, you know, and it took a lot of work to help them reconfigure that.
Right. Well, at the very least, it explains, and I think most people can probably identify that with this in one form or another, most less extreme, where we actually do have more power than a lot of those kids that we used to work with actually had. It can be a sort of justification for resistance, right? When you feel that resistance, when you don't want to do something, you're like, okay, well, let's come up with a reason why this is the case, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's very tempting to point to fixed, unchangeable aspects of ourselves because that makes it so we don't have to do any more hard work. You know,
exactly.
We can just say, hey, that's just me. You know, I know that I still do this in certain aspects of my life, right? Like physically, I think it's probably the most obvious example where there have been times in my life where I've been in great shape. Now is not one of those times. And I'll just say like, well, I've just got this nagging shoulder thing that prevents me from, you know, lifting weights in the way I would want to. And then I subconsciously just use that to set down all of the other goals I might have around getting in better shape, right? Because, hey, that's easy. I can just now go focus my energies on something else rather than self-improvement. But
that that brings us to another really important aspect of this. We're going to talk a little bit about homeschool moment, but you this is a new app that is actually being developed right now that you're working on, but you have a blog on the site homeschoolmoment.app, and the blog was called The First 3 Steps to Homeschooling in April of 2020. And one of the other ones that you talk about on there was routine. And we're kind of in that now as far as like countering that resistance. So I told you the story about, you know, I get in the car, I come back here, not with a super well-developed plan. I just know where I need to be. I'll stay with my mom for a while and I'll figure things out. You know, this breaks immediately, breaks all my routines. Work routine, fitness routine, obviously having my gym clothes and be 600 miles away also contributed to that. And that seems like a pretty good excuse. But it took me a good 10 days to reset and get, and I mean, I'm still like the routines that I relied on a lot, like things like, you know, journaling, meditation, like a lot of that stuff has been slow to return to the way that it was, but it's getting there and it's been better. You know, day by day, week by week that I've been here, but I had a really good excuse, you know, I had a really good excuse to kind of let go of lots of things that even though they are habitual, still have small amounts of resistance attached to them. And like I said, now most of that is fixed, but I went through that period and I think that this is just me, you know, and maybe I have a couple other people to consider, but it's you, your wife, 3 young children. You said your parents are in the mix because they're right next door. So routine must be fairly important to your whole system there. And what happened in the wake of this event? How did you lose it for a while? Did you have to recover it? And how do you establish it or maintain it in these new times? Because I bet there's a lot of people, as far as like advice to those who are new to this world of trying to learn at home, who are still working to build it. You know, or don't even realize how chaotic it is because they don't have it.
Yeah. So for starters, it totally upended everything for us. I mean, on a basic level, my wife and I, we have always been a single income family, like ever since our first child was one, but that's looked a lot of different ways. You know, I used to run a summer camp and I was the only one working. Once we left camp in 2014, I was probably doing 75% of the work where my wife was doing about 25%. You know, we each had our own businesses, basically. We maintained that pace until almost exactly 1 month ago today when all of professional sports in the United States were shut down. And my main business happens to be helping people to gamble on a certain kind of fantasy sports. So with no service to offer, we had to stop collecting revenue. And we still do have expenses. So we're trying to figure out how to navigate that. But yeah, I mean, on March 11th, I could make money. On March 12th, I could not. And that was pretty difficult, or at least for that one segment of my income. I have some other bips and bobs here and there, but nothing significant. So yeah, right away I went from working 80%, 75% of our work hours to now about 10%, working on this app and a few other things. And then my wife has taken on, you know, 30, 35 hours a week. And that's been a huge transition, not only for us, because that's not our normal rhythm, but also for our kids. You know, they're used to seeing us certain times of day, certain amounts per day. There are different types of activities we each like to do with them. And overnight that was upended. And so the question we had to ask ourselves was, how do we make the new plan going forward? Because I think there are two sorts of routines one can establish. You can have your emergency routine, right? Where you say, I have to get through this for the next 2 weeks, right? This is my last 2 weeks, and I don't even know what a good example would be, training for a marathon maybe, or, you know, something that you're willing to do for a short period of time that you're not willing to do forever. And I think it's okay to look at something and say, yeah, I can do this for 2 weeks, a month, a year. But if there's a finite endpoint to it, then that gives some peace of mind. I don't think the current situation lends itself very well to that, at least until you're building towards a more sustainable or stable routine. And so that leads me to the next kind of routine, which is, can I live with this forever? That's a lens I try to look at most things in my life through, whether it's my own working arrangements, personal arrangements too, you know, personal relationships. I try to think, this person I care about acts in this one way. That way is not ideal for me, but can I live with it? Or do I need to speak to them and try to figure out if we can change this in some way so that my needs can be met in a better fashion? And certainly for this scenario, I believe it will just be sort of an open-ended, I don't know that in the very near future, we're going to have a, all right, everyone back to work sort of day,
yeah.
Or at least I'm going to act that way. And so everything we're trying to do around the home right now is trying to move towards something that feels good on all those important fronts to us. So, you know, interpersonally, are we connecting with friends and people we care about? Are we staying in shape? Because, you know, fitness is important to me and my wife. Are our kids having their needs met? And kind of going from there and understanding that if we try to do the unsustainable thing, which I think is what a lot of people are trying to do right now, they're trying to work from home and have their kids go to school at home. And they're trying to maybe even find new work because they're out of work now or whatever. And it's not feeling sustainable. And that threat, that looming feeling of, I can't do this forever, I think is a huge source of, you know, an unmet need in people's lives, a huge source of stress that maybe people can't even pinpoint, this feeling of, I won't be able to do this forever. So I'm really stressed out about it.
Yeah. I think that there's, I can think of various groups that I feel especially sympathetic for right now, like especially people who rely on school for food and childcare and, you know, a lot of that is determined by their economic situation. And, you know, even though I disagree with it in practice, the people who put a lot of stress on like timetables in the keeping up with the Joneses ways of academics, like the people that I used to tutor in the greater Boston area and how competitive that was and how timetable driven every, and it, like, you know, with college as the, you know, at least the first goal, that's got to be really, really frustrating for a lot of these people. But I'm sure everybody feels that. And I think there's a lot of people who right from the beginning are like, I give up, I don't know what to do. But there's also people who are probably taking the same approach that a lot of people will take to like diet or fitness on New Year's Day. You know, like I can do this, this is going to be great. And they kind of overload themselves and they burn out really quickly.
I should turn to you for my analogy. That's a much better one than my marathon one from before. Exactly. I'm going to go to the gym 6 days a week. It's like, well, you're probably not going to do that.
Right. So I think there's a lot of people right now who haven't done that timescale question with themselves, right? Can I live with this forever? And I think what's required, and I'd want to hear about how this works in your household or how it has worked so far, is speaking of routine and resistance, one of the things that I have resisted more than any other practice in the entire world is doing a weekly review, right? And there's all of this like productivity guru, weekly review, one-upsmanship where it's like my weekly review is 3 hours long. My weekly review is six. You know, my weekly review is the whole day of Sunday every year. And I've just never really found a way to do it that is sustainable. Every weekly review is just, you know, the first day of the gym after New Year's for me. Like I can, this is going to be great. I remember trying to do one that was like 3 hours long and I finished it and I was like, it's going to be the only one of those. It's going to be the only time I do that. But what I'm realizing is like when I was at home in Pittsburgh and following my routine, it's like, yeah, this is something I do every day, always and forever. This is something that I do 5 or 6 times a week. And what would change that? I have this, I don't know what it is, just this need to go to the grocery store every other day that was suddenly snatched away from me, right? You know, this satisfaction of like, I'd go to the gym, I'd go to the grocery store and look at new food, look at fresh vegetables. I haven't seen fresh vegetables in 6 weeks, you know, aside from what we've been able to gather from local farms here. But I haven't been in like a really nice, you know, produce section of the Trader Joe's in a long time. And, you know, I obviously wasn't ready for that. So anyway, the point is, I had a lot of routines that were just on autopilot because I didn't think anything could take them away from me. And because of that, I didn't need to do like super frequent reassessments of all the things that I was doing in my life, whether they had to do with, you know, self-care or work or fitness or whatever. Now I actually do find that it is helpful every Sunday to sit down and kind of like reassess, and also to plan for a new week ahead that might be different, where less things are possible or more things are in the way, or there's more considerations that need to be made. So as far as trying to establish routines for a family, do you find that these reassessments have to be more frequent at this point?
Yeah. Well, on some level, I think we've hit a pretty good equilibrium with it right now. But, you know, one of the ways we look at things like this is sort of through an old consensus building technique that I learned, I don't know how long ago now, but sitting down and kind of putting the important things in our lives into buckets. So all members of our family are welcome to be a part of this, and then figure out what we would love to have, what we would like to have, and what we can live with. And when you put things in buckets that way, I think it helps clarify what the priorities really are, because you start to realize very quick, and you have to reassess, like, can I still live with this, or, you know, do I need to change this? So it's not really a weekly review process necessarily, but it is a check-in that lets us know. And if we also have sort of an expectation of being honest, like the framework, I don't think I've ever talked to this or talked to you about this before, but there's a website I've used called clearcommunicate.org or .com or something. Anyway, it was developed by another camp director friend of mine, and he has a lot of great tools for helping people to communicate more honestly. But one of the pieces he taught me was this idea of asking for 100%, where the expectation that goes two ways is, like, if you and I live together, if I want something from you, I must ask you for it. That's the burden on me. But then the burden gets passed to you that if you don't want to give it to me, then you must tell me. So,
right.
We try to have this expectation among all lines of relationship in our family. So from me to each of my sons, from me to my wife, and all of them to each other too, because the thing we want to really avoid is someone having an unmet need that's unspoken. I think that's when the resentment can really build. And yeah. So, and when it comes to routine, you know, sometimes it's obvious when people are asking for 100% that we can't meet 100% of everyone's needs. But at least that gets it out on the table, and we can kind of jigsaw puzzle it together from there. And that's worked pretty well for us. Like I said, we've now reached a point where for me and my wife, we're getting out hiking once or twice a week, trying to do that in a responsible way, obviously. For the kids, you know, they're seeing my parents quite a bit. Because like I said, they live right next door. You know, they're trying to make progress in the things that are important to them. We're trying to support them in those the best way we can. But yeah, it wasn't easy at first. You know, getting everything upended right away certainly took a lot of deliberation. But I'm happy with where we are now.
Excellent. Can we talk a little bit about this app that you're building, which obviously Sure. would have been useful beyond the situation, but obviously I think a lot of people could discover a utility for this right now, especially as they more and more people, and I'm seeing reports of this, really contemplate moving beyond traditional schooling because, yeah, I mean, maybe there's some headaches in like trying to manage academics, but they might see happier, freer children who are not suddenly surrendering 9 or 10 hours of every day to school. Maybe yeah. the new distance compulsory schooling requires 4 or 5 hours a day. It requires a more flexible wake time, which is suitable to the circadian rhythms of a 14-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 17-year-old, whatever. And people have, you know, more self-direction. They have, even though this seems like, considering a lot of things floating around in the news right now, a bit of an irony, but they feel like they have more privacy, you know? And that might just produce the appearance and genuine wellness in these kids that maybe parents don't really get to see. You know, now they have this kind of A-B comparison that they can do of like, oh, 2 months ago, I wasn't seeing any of these positive qualities from my son or my daughter, but now they're emergent because of this situation. I think if parents are managing their own stress, which obviously I understand must be, it has a lot of its own challenges. Just like, even if you had no children, this is a stressful time for many people, for sure, with their work situations, their financial situations, the uncertainty, all of that. But if they are balanced enough to observe what's happening with their children, I think many people are seeing happier, you know, more relaxed, less bored kids right now. And that's a great
thing. Yeah, it's funny.
Because of that, they're thinking, okay, well, what is possible other than what we've just been accepting without thinking about, you know, for so long?
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. It reminds me of when I was working at camp full time, and with some frequency, probably two or three times a fall, I would get a call from a parent who would ask something along the lines of, hey, you know, was my kid really well behaved at camp this summer? And I'd say, yeah, Cole's great. You know, he was the life of the party, so fun. And he would go around and help the other kids make their bunks. And, you know, I'd share the same stories that were true in the summer and still true in the fall. And they'd say, yeah, because we tried a new school this year and he's been sent to the principal every day for the first 2 weeks of school, you know, and like, we're really trying to figure out like what was different about camp versus what's going on in school. And I'd pause and try not to say, well, everything is different about it, but help them to reflect that there is a happy version of their child if they're willing to unlock it. And I think school is seen, like we talk about routine, you know, I don't like brushing my teeth, but I no longer resent brushing my teeth the way I did when I was five, right? I'm like, it's just part of the routine and I can live with it. I think a lot of people get there with school, and a lot of parents get there with forcing their kids to go to school, where it's just this part of routine and it's not great, but it's also not like awful the way some kids experience it. But I think for many parents right now, they are seeing happier kids in their home, right? They're seeing these kids that, especially the ones that are, say, let's, you know, bullied by the other kids in school, or
absolutely, yeah,
bullied by the teachers, right? Or hate to be called on to read in front of the class. You know, all these kids that are somewhat traumatized by the school experience.
You're just naturally introverted, you know? I mean,
yeah, right,
and then think about that.
Exactly.
Then you're in a hallway where you have to walk through a gauntlet of 300 people in 4 minutes, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And so the objection in the past was, well, hey, they still need all this academic stuff. But let's say this lasts until September, right?
Mm-hmm.
If those kids have still made whatever academic progress their parents require of them, but are 10 times happier, I have to think that some sizable percentage of parents will look at that and say, what are we doing here? You know, do we have to send Mary back to school where she's going to be tortured because she's got braces? Or can she stay at home and learn the things we think she should learn, but also not be miserable 24/7, or look at some alternatives? You know, like I've done work with liberated learner centers. I did my own sort of alternative option out here before this whole thing happened, where I would get together with kids that weren't in school on Fridays. There are just a lot of options these days. You know, there's tons of different online options that people can pursue. So I do think you could see homeschooling, you know, a lot of people just kind of stay in whatever new routine they're developing right now because it actually happens to work better. And I think there are a number of potential silver linings like that. I tend to be a somewhat optimistic person, but I'd have to think this is going to speed up, like, you know, automation and the advancements of delivery technologies and working from home. I think we could see a lot of really positive things come from this, alongside all the really awful things too. But, you know, I tend to try to view things optimistically. So that's what I'm focusing on right now.
Yeah, there is a bit of a roller coaster with that too, where I was saying in the monologue of the Kerry McDonald show, it's like, while I'm shopping for ammo and storing dry food, I can't also be, you know, pontificating about my faith in humanity. You know, it just seems kind of inconsistent.
Right.
So you do go back and forth, right? You do go back and forth. And part of that is preparation. But sure, I see, you know, given the circumstances, a lot of bad things happening in the near future and maybe over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, societally, governmentally, I would say even more severely. But at the same time, yeah, it just comes back to, like, a crisis will show you the worst of humanity and it will show you the best. And, you know, hopefully the best is in a high enough volume and with a high enough volume in what they're doing and, you know, projecting it out. And hopefully people like us can help with that, that more people are going to say, yeah, all right, that's somebody making the very best of a not so ideal situation that was thrust upon them all of a sudden. Maybe I could do that too. You know, especially
and I think
seeing same observations with their kids.
I think you can hold all these thoughts at once too. Like you talked about, well, can I store ammo and get dry food while also seeing the best in humanity? I think you can actually. I think that, you know, probabilistically, I don't think we're going to wind up in a situation where people are trying to rob me for my dried food anytime soon. But there's no real cost to my future to prepare to defend myself just in case, right? And you know, one of the things I did in a different past life was I played poker professionally, and one thing that you learn very quickly when you're working in a field with these sort of uncertainties is that unusual things happen. And the one in 100 shots come in, one in 50,000 shots come in, all those come in at some point. And if it's not a material cost to your life, then you can just be prepared. And I think you can be prepared and still be optimistic. And I think it's really challenging for people to overcome their default way of seeing things. You know, there's a famous poker author who once wrote that poker is only profitable because people only understand things in terms of 50-50 scenarios, right? Will this happen or won't it? And I don't think you have to live your life that way to have a happy and profitable and successful life. I think you can allow for those one percenters, hope that the gun stays in the safe or wherever for the rest of your life. And then your kids are surprised to see it or whatever when they come of age. But also still have the gun in the safe, you know?
And also to remember, I think a part of the preparation for that and having the right mindset for that, which again, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I think that's a really valuable addition to this conversation is, you know, we live in a country where there's a media presence and a social media presence that is going to magnify those 1%, right? Yeah. Like as soon as there's civil unrest over food shortages, we're going to see it, right? As soon as there's negative outcomes from kids being stuck at home and forced to do school at home, we're going to see it. We're already hearing talk about upticks in child abuse, domestic violence, all of these things, and the media. And that's not to say the media is inventing these things. I'm sure they're real. I'm sure lots of people are really, really struggling. The media is going to amplify those worst features of humanity to get people. And this is all forms of media, right? This is not just the mainstream CNN. And this is like anybody who can use these things to get clicks and to get views, not anybody, but a lot of people are going to utilize them. So there's also a kind of preparedness, you know, just emotional for that, whether we're parents or we're talking about how to prepare our kids for these things. We're probably going to see a lot of bad things over the next year, even if they don't affect us directly. I think you're absolutely right. Where I am or where I'm planning to be, I'm not too worried about those kinds of things. But they are going to happen and we are going to see them. And they are going to be, you know, as presented as if this is what's normal or this is what to expect from, you know, humanity or society in the future.
Yeah. You know, you've talked a lot about that intellectual self-defense. I think this is a great opportunity to help our kids learn about that, right? You know, the fact that this has turned into a political football in a lot of ways and, you know, both sides just clawing over each other, not only just to spend more money, more of the taxpayers' money, but also to try to defame one another and besmirch one another and just be nasty and ridiculing 24/7. But also, like you said, to either gin up fear or gin up not fear, right? Like there's other people on that are talking about this and just trying to downplay the severity and from my perspective, or try to, you know, only look at the optimistic outcomes and so on. And I think that's the time where it's great to sit down with a child and say, here's one side that says this. Why do you think they might say that? Why, you know, what, how would they benefit from portraying a situation this way? And now here's the other side. How do you think they would benefit from portraying the situation in the totally opposite way? And we can understand that one of these sides might actually be right, even though they're very motivated to present this viewpoint, they could still also have the right viewpoint, right? So just because you found that someone could have an ulterior motive for something doesn't mean they're wrong. And it's very, very hard to navigate through this. My perception is that a lot of very smart, liberty-minded folks that I know have allowed, you know, their anti-authority heuristic to block them from seeing some real dangers that I think this whole situation presents. And I, you know, I don't hope to sound superior to them or anything, but I think it's a time where everyone needs to look and say, like, yeah, these have been my biases. This is my worldview. These are my principles. And this is a new situation. So how do I look at it with a beginner's mind, you know?
Yeah, like Al Gore was on Real Time with Bill Maher just Friday night doing a, you know, like a Skype interview or whatever. And the title of the video that I saw was The Climate Change Connection to this whole situation. Now, it's not to say that that's even completely invented, but the point is like everybody has their thing, right? Everybody has their brand. And when something like this happens, it's all like, how can we seize upon this opportunity to tie this in and how can I use this to show people why I've been right all along? And like when this whole thing happened, I didn't want to say anything because I don't ever want to do anything that looks like gloating or I told you so. I mean, the opportunities that I think I would get to do it anyway might be somewhat rare where people would actually be able to make the connection. But you see a lot of that. You see a lot of people saying, look, I've been saying this for 20. How many people are out there right now saying, I've been saying this for 20 years. I've been saying this for 25 years.
It is an ugly instinct. And I had to hesitate to embrace that own instinct to myself sometimes. And I'm sure many people do. But, you know, people will do this with like the rising death total in the United States, you know, like reporting this gleefully, like, see, he said there was only going to be, we would be reopened by Easter. 2,000 people died today. It's like, yeah, that's cause for celebration. Like this guy that you don't like was wrong about something. And but also 2,000 people died. So, you know, being right is not the only thing that matters. And it's not the only thing, like, you're not smart just because you were right either. So don't don't value yourself based on whether you happen to have one or two right takes at some point, because you're opening yourself up also to be evaluated by your wrong takes, which we'll all have plenty of. And I don't know, I think it's a very important time to stay curious in the world, because I don't really think anyone knows what they're fully talking about or has a perfect model for what's to come. So, you know, falling into your predictable lane of every time there's a school shooting, right, there's Democrats lined up to take away guns, and then there's, you know, libertarians and so on to line up to say, well, if they allowed guns in this place, then we wouldn't have had it, you know. And it's like, hey, everyone fall into your things. We got a school shooting. Everyone places people. Let's go. Let's all say the things we always say. It's like, you could just not do that.
My first observation of that was with libertarians. I remember I think we spent a whole hour on this on Free Talk Live back when I was a co-host. So this was probably like 2014. Mm-hmm. And I just call it like libertarian victory lap, where something happens where it's proven that the government can't help or protect people, right? Yes. And so this victory lap takes place on Facebook, but what actually happened there was people died, people were displaced, people had, if they lived, they had their lives destroyed, and you're gloating about it because you're right. I think that's like certainly misplaced priorities. The other problem with gloating, just generally speaking, is gloating is only useful if you're doing it in front of somebody who is willing to change their behaviors or the way they think. Mm-hmm. And in politics, that is getting to be less and less the case as each day goes by and echo chamber walls just continue to get higher and higher, right? So gloating is just a not effective and a very bad look as far as outreach is concerned. So I've been warning people about this for years. So yeah.
You have been warning us for years. But I think it's well taken. And I think, you know, one of the other things I had to examine in myself, and I try to continue to examine very frequently, is, you know, what really brought me to the ideas of liberty in the first place, right? Was it only that I was trying to find the best, most peaceful political system in the world, or, you know, maximum human thriving? I'm sure on some level I've always connected with it for those reasons, but also, like, I do have a need to feel right about things, right? And so when I found this thing that helped me to feel right more often, and this lens that I found, and when I put it right into focus, I was like, oh, it turns out I'm right about this, and I'm right about this, and I'm right about this other thing. And that was, you know, it's like the old ring from Lord of the Rings, right? I'm like, ooh, yeah, I'm just right now. And that's my version of power. I don't need to rule anyone, but if I can know inside that I'm right, I have this part of me that really loves that feeling. And I hope to, you know, nurture that part of myself and not hate it, but also acknowledge that that part is like sort of an asshole sometimes and is very unpersuasive as well. And if I actually care about the things that I'd like to think I do, like the human thriving and finding the best answers, that other part, the know-it-all part that likes to be right, needs to just be quiet. So that's what I'm trying to work on right now too. It's hard not to, there's really high stakes right now too. And it's hard not to want to put forth the right, what you feel is the right viewpoint. And I recognize that too, but, you know, just ask myself how helpful it is. And if that's the best use of that 5 minutes or not, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I was talking to my friend, Scott Pambrick, who's been on my show a bunch of times. We were just having a private conversation about this. And one of his observations that I'll share publicly, and I think he shared publicly, is like, this situation is going to get rid of a lot of unnecessary stuff, right? Like, it's going to blow away a lot of the garbage. And right now, people, or for many years now, people have been able to sort of posit theories and pontificate about them with very low stakes. And now, like, day by day, week by week, they're going to have the things they say tested by reality, right? Mm. There's going to be a really clear cause and effect. And that might mean, you know, the end for a bunch of sort of fear-based conspiracy websites, but it might mean the end for CNN or the New York Times, you know, as people just sort of wise up to, like, hey, you know, I'm glued to this thing 6 hours a day. The stuff that you keep telling me is going to happen isn't happening, right? You're not creating a realistic model of what I'm seeing, right? This is not a good map of reality that you're giving me. I'll be very curious to
see if that plays out politically, because, you know, politicians are especially unaccountable, not only while they're in office, but, you know, incumbents get reelected at these absolutely outrageous rates. And just have a lot of people on record saying factually inaccurate things that caused or at least contributed to the cause of many deaths, right? And like, if they can bounce back from that, maybe that would also lead a lot of other people to say, okay, yeah, this system is just totally broken, right? You know, the same conclusion that many of us in the liberty community have arrived to. I would have to think that some people who still hold out hope that we can just vote the bad guys out, if they see the bad guys causing deaths on TV and just not being held to accord for it, maybe at least at that point, they'll say, hey, you know what? Turns out this system of we all vote in the guy we like the best isn't the way to run everyone's lives, you know? But yeah, right. Time will tell. This is certainly a truly unique time to be alive.
Indeed. So before we wrap up, can you tell us a little bit about Homeschool Moment?
Sure. Yeah, Homeschool Moment. Yeah, so we actually started this well in advance of the current crisis. So hopefully it will be a well-placed product for people that are needing it. But basically the idea was, for those of us in the homeschooling community, in many states, there is this portfolio requirement where you have to document what your kid is learning, present it to some well-meaning authority, and they can, you know, in New Hampshire, they just give you recommendations. There's no real enforcement mechanism, but you are supposed to go through this process. And it's very stressful. You know, many of us who got into homeschooling didn't get into it to maintain huge closets full of three-ring binders and,
sure,
you know, stuffed full of crinkled artwork and things like that. We got into it because we wanted to connect with our kids, and adding additional logistics onto that when it's already pretty logistically challenging is just sort of a nightmare. So what we wanted to do was create an application that's as easy and fun to use as Instagram, because I think a lot of people like the idea of homeschooling and they really want to document what their kids are up to. But when push comes to shove, like homeschooling just makes you really busy and you're focused on a lot. And these moments just kind of slip by. The kid does a cool project, then the other child calls in from the next room to summon you over. And before you know it, the kid you were just hanging out with is moved on to something else and so on. So yeah, being able to just have this thing on you that's sort of your ubiquitous moment capturing device to kind of use a getting things done-ism has been really helpful for me. We actually do have a functional version of the app live right now that we've been testing internally. We're right about to release it to a small group of closed beta testers before we release it to the public. So yeah, it's been a really exciting project to work on, mostly because it meets an actual need that I have in my own life. And it's really nice to be able to just have the same place where my wife and I can both check in, you know, especially since we have this sort of joint arrangement where we each spend time with the kids. You know, if she's super busy with something one day and doesn't get done with work until maybe even after some of the kids are asleep, she can just log into the app and see, oh, look what the kids got up to today. That's cool. And let's be honest, it's also reassuring, because I think one of the biggest struggles people have with the idea of homeschooling is that they feel like they won't do a good job. And when you are monitoring and keeping track of all the incredible stuff your kids get up to, it's hard not to feel like you're doing a good job, right? I mean, even in a house where people are, you know, quote unquote, just playing video games, if you actually sat and captured the things your kids were working on, the connections they were making, the progress they were making in whatever we're working on, I think most people would be surprised as to all the cool stuff their kids are actually up to when they're able to take that step back and be more of a, you know, documentarian of their child's lives as well as an engaged actor. So yeah, we're pretty pumped about it. And yeah, definitely excited to bring it to market.
Yeah. And I had a pretty, I think, healthy and positive attitude towards home education when I started to actually work as a tutor with a few unschooled. I was actually already doing the podcast. So yeah, I should have been in really good shape. But these were kids, I remember one kid specifically who was in like the Concord, New Hampshire area, who had been taken out of school. And I was just sort of like a home education facilitator. I would come by a few days a week. So immediately this picture pops in my head back then, this was 10 years ago, of like file cabinets and grade books, because that's what keeping track of a kid meant throughout my entire career. So I think maybe a lot of parents have this picture of the arduous task of properly recording the academics of their child. I mean, I had it and I should have known better. But fortunately, the school district that I was working with and the advisor who was managing this relationship was, you know, really hands-off, really understanding, really in favor of authentic assessments, and really also granted the kid might have not been the easiest for the public schools to handle. So they were happy that he was, you know, his work was in my hands. But all of that combined into like a pretty enjoyable, not like real paperwork heavy process. So I think as more people might be embracing this over the next couple of years, when I was first reading about Homeschool Moment, I was like, oh, this is a really nice transitional step where people already are comfortable using a technology like this. They're already happy to use it because they're using it to record their own lives. And now it's just kind of being extended into this portfolio building for their child's education. So yeah, I think it's a great time for that. And more people, I hope even people who are still in the situation where their kids are doing 4 or 5 hours a day of government school in front of a computer or whatever, are finding, could find opportunities for something like this. Just having slightly for your children.
Right. Just documenting the things that are important to you in a way, in a place where it's just kept. You know, one of the things, the productivity techniques that's been very important for my life has been, you know, things having a place and things being in their place where I can go reference them in the future. And, sure. you know, even something like, you know, my wife was always making a Christmas calendar for our relatives every year, where she would give it to them and be a calendar of, you know, our kids and what we've been up to throughout the year. And it's not like for everyone, like you probably don't want one, but for like our parents and my brothers and for her, stressful, like, oh, where was that picture? Was that uploaded to the cloud? You know, and just having that one place where you can go and say, here's what Ezra, one of my sons, got up to when he was 7. Like, I don't know. We're excited to be using it already. And hopefully we'll keep it into the future. So even though actually like for us, we're not that concerned with documenting things academically, even though the app can be used for that. You know, you can document, you know, your kids' worksheets and, you know, eventually you'll be able to export it and present it to the person that you need to report to. For us, it's just kind of cool to have, this is the place where the things that Ezra accomplished during the year live. Like that's exciting to me. Even if I weren't homeschooling, I would probably want something like that, because like if I really check in with like my own, like the record keeping for my childhood, yeah, there are a lot of pictures and there's these bins full of like schoolwork I did or whatever, but it's not comprehensible. And I would love to be able to, like, I know that these moments are rushing by me right now, and I really look forward to being able to refer back to them in the future. So
if people in my audience want to learn more about it, they can go to homeschoolmoment.app.
Yep. And we have a mailing list right there. So you can just get on the mailing list if you're curious. We'll keep people abreast of if we do an open beta when that's launched, but certainly when we launch the app more properly. And we write our thoughts there too. We do have a little blog. Right now it's mostly focused on processing this crazy time with your kids at home. And in the future, it'll be probably a little bit more tactical about fun things to do with your kids. But that's kind of what we're up to right now.
Awesome. Last time you and Taylor were both on the show, we were talking about One Free Family, which was a podcast that you were doing. And you did wind up with like 50 something episodes, right?
Yeah, we did a year. We really loved it. We loved the community that we built and all that stuff. But we simultaneously started running low on things that we wanted to say. And we ran up against needing to make more money. That was the first kind of stage of this. That was last May. So yeah, we've talked about spinning it back up. But I think for us, like, we got to make sure the oxygen mask is fully affixed to our financial situation before we get involved in more hobbies like that. But yeah.
That makes perfect sense to me. I get that. But it's lots of great advice. And I think when we talked about it, and again, like a whole year's worth of content for people to go through, it's still up on, it's on YouTube. It's on the...
I think we have our podcast feed still live too, if I'm not
mistaken. Okay, yeah, it's on Apple, whatever they call that now.
Stitcher is where I listen. It's still on there too.
Yep, so. Stitcher. I'm happy to project that further. I'll find a good link and I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Cool.
But yeah, it was great to talk to you again. It's been too long. We should do this more often. And hopefully we get to see each other in person sometime during the year 2020.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, now that you're back in New Hampshire, yeah, we'll get to all... sit on the lawn in Exeter or somewhere else at some point in the future. It'll be good times.